Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the privilege of interviewing Phil Ross of MycoWorks. A pioneer in cultivating living materials for art and design, Phil began using mycelium in the 1990s as a medium for sculpture. Now, almost three decades on, Phil and his team of artists are now complemented by engineers, biologists, production specialists, and material scientists in bringing the first fine mycelium material, Reishi, to the world. Anyone who sees his work or hears him speak can't help but have their mind set alight by a spark of inspiration. He's one of those unique individuals who can take something ancient, like fungi, derive novel uses for it, and not only shift how we see fungi, unlock new ideas and new fields of discovery, but really expand humanity's entire realm of what is possible. His lifetime of work with mycelium hints at a vast ocean of infinite opportunity that await humanity as we explore kingdom fungi. Coming to us from my neck of the woods in the Bay Area of California, Phil, it's an honor to have you on the Mushroom Hour.
Wow. Thank you so much. This is a great show, and I have spent many hours listening to these interviews and listening to all of these other people who it's very inspiring. So thank you for providing this. It's great.
Well, it's certainly a privilege to get to speak with amazing people like yourself. I'm really excited for this interview. And we were just talking before the show about the Mushroom Minute. And so maybe you're the first one who has to step up to the challenge. The biography of Phil Ross, mycologist, anthropologist, artist, 1 minute. Here we go.
1 minute? Oh my gosh. I don't know. I started doing macrobiotic cooking with biodynamic vegetables. This was back in the mid to late 80s, and doing large scale cooking of fresh ingredients that were, knew the farmers and had their stuff delivered to the door, and then cooking for 1,000 people from those fresh ingredients 3 times a day, so it's like a through processing of just an incredible volume of living material.
That's insane.
And so, yeah, I know. But it was like, I was a straight D student in high school, so I was one of those people who like was good with his hands and, just loved cooking. And so that was, for me, a real obvious choice was to get into it. And I just went into it really deep. And then this cooking at that large a volume was just an awesome education into the practicum of biotechnology. It has the same roots going back into the 1850s with Louis Pasteur, who created this rationalized idea of food production, but also at the same time of pasteurization and how to process biomaterials in enclosed spaces using all these kind of techniques of industry at the time with steam, heat and containment of vessels and all this other sort of stuff that was happening in the mechanical realm. And so anyway, it was just, that's my mushroom 3 minutes. Fail.
Mushroom 3 minutes. But I love you just made that analogy of preparing food as the roots of biotechnology. Interesting. I hadn't thought of that before.
Yeah. If you go back to French cuisine, which was really formalized in a certain way at that time, it was kind of frozen, was because the French have a highly codified recipe system. So like they have measurements for dice, for mince, for julienne, for chiffonade. Like they're very precise. And then how you cook them at the temperatures like has to do with thermal transmission and then say, heat, cooling, and then treating with acid baths or bases and then making mixtures and all that stuff was written into recipes. And that was the same stuff that also led to making wine at a large scale that didn't spoil and cheeses and all of the industrial production of food that's really typical and normal these days. Before that, there would be up to 50% spoilage from, from microorganisms getting in there. And so, Pasteur figured out what those microorganisms were, and it was the creation of what we now call pure cultures. That is, in the microorganismal range, like how to get a yeast that is just yeast, or how to get a bacterial strain to make something that is just that bacteria and doesn't have all the other ambient things that are floating around in the air all the time and covering everything else. And, you know, he was able to also prove that this was how rot happens, was through germ theory. And so that led to, you know, all of our modern science around surgeries and bioengineering and the production of medicines and vitamin C and all that other stuff comes from that root. So if you do learn cooking of a certain order, you will get a training into the practicum of bioengineering and biotechnology. It is the same thing if you go back to that. And I did not know that at the time. I was just, you know, when I was 20 years old, I was just like, this is cool. I can cook, you know, food for 1,000 people using these giant steam cooking things and big freezers and giant things of standardized acetic acid, white vinegar, you know, which had been produced by the same processes. And I could use that in the tens of gallons. And it was the same stuff I would be using tomorrow and the next day too. There's just a standardization of all those ingredients. And, you know, I didn't know it. And then when I eventually got to making mushrooms, when I saw my first, what's called a protocol, you know, the steps one takes in carrying out a particular technical experiment, I was like, oh, this is a recipe. You know, it was just like, this is just a well-described recipe, which is getting into like the temperatures and the calibration of the equipment. And I had also done pastry cooking, you know, making desserts and cookies and breads and all that other stuff at scale. And I understood that it was like closer to pastry cooking, like where you can even at large scale cooking, you can fudge a lot. That is, you can say like, oh, this needs a little more fat or salt or sweet or acid. And, you know, throw in a gallon of that to balance out your stuff. But in precision cooking, which is pastry, your oven has to be the exact temperature that you expect it to be, because like you're getting down to cooking things to the second. And if you go off by 15 seconds, you can ruin your dish. Or if the measurements on your thermometer on your stovetop are wrong, you will burn your sugars or all this other sort of stuff. So I was like, pastry is really the outer end of cooking, getting towards, you know, the beginnings of bioengineering and where that crossover really happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's getting to kind of an exact science. So you're following actually a very well-worn path. And it's something that I think is really interesting that I've heard you bring up before, including our own conversations, talking about human tropisms and, you know, how things stay the same across all these different disciplines. It's just kind of human things. So yeah, a box that modulates heat to grow things, or putting things in a jar and heating it up. I mean, whether it's cooking or science, you find these same things going on.
Yeah, I think that word tropism,
you know, that's a really, you know, that's used in biology. And I didn't really know that word before I got into biology. And so, I mean, it means like what drawing towards, like what is an organism drawn towards? And it's the same thing like with the word trophy. You know, it's like we aspire towards this, or this is the reward for us. Right. And we are going towards the reward. And that's like the same thing, like the organism is going towards the reward, which might be more oxygen or more light or more food, or there, you know, there's negative tropisms, like you go away from it's too hot, or you go away from it's too cold, or you go away from there's no food, negative tropism. And yeah, humans are drawn towards food, like it's just an area of it because we have to eat and we like to eat. And that's also like where we express most of our culture. Like we're not just jumping on living things and devouring them whole whenever we get the opportunity to do so, but we have this like highly constrained and, you know, socially conformed to ideas of what food is and how we encounter it and where we encounter it and what makes it food and what makes it not food. And like that is, there's a very famous anthropological book at the beginning of, you know, the field of it called The Raw and the Cooked by Claude Levi-Strauss on this very subject of like, what, like, you know, yeah, you could just go out and start eating stuff and that is your right as an animal on earth to do so, you know, but then when you become a human, you have to eat in particular ways, and that defines your humanness and even the locality of your humanness. Like it changes depending upon where you are on the earth as to like what's okay to eat and what's anyway.
This whole thing of tropism though,
of like, yeah, going towards cooking, you know, that's an area of human interest, and you will always find people doing things there and novel, you know, expressions of stuff, because it is so variable across the earth. And we have to reconcile those cultural differences with this technium, you know, this understanding of what it is we're doing.
Right. Well, when did fungi enter the picture? Because clearly you are on the path to pursuing some kind of biological science. You're already working with all kinds of different organisms and making food and almost scientific processes. So when did fungi enter the picture for you?
Well, I grew up in New York City, and I had nominal exposure to mushrooms, other than the typical sort of like disgusting things on pizza you might find from a big can, like at the pizzeria. Right. I was sort of like, I was like, they would dip their hands with this like 1 gallon can of things and sprinkle them on top of the pizza and make it worse. And that was like my, you know, that was my upbringing with mushrooms, you know, except maybe I would encounter them in Chinese food or other cuisine, not knowing that they were mushrooms. But that was about it. And then when I was in my 20s, that's really when I started that. And that was working at this place where I was doing this kind of, vegetarian sleepaway camp in the middle of the Adirondacks. And one of the other chefs was like, hey, let's go mushroom hunting. And I had never done that before. And it was like right out the back door of the kitchen was this gigantic mixed wood forest. Like that was where we lived and slept and everything else. And it was like, it was right there. And within an hour, we came back with this giant basket of beautiful, weird things that we then cooked each one of them. You know, we had this nice kitchen. And so we're just like, let's do the standard cooking. We'll just saute them in olive oil with a little salt, like just the nominal. And we just tried each one like that. And it was like each one tasted different. Each one had a different texture. You know, each one just, you know, behaved differently in the pan. So as a food person, it was mind blowing. And it was right there out the back door was like this pantry of exploration. And, you know, I was probably about 23 or something like that. And it was the cipher. It was the key for me to understand nature, because, you know, it was just interesting aesthetically. Each mushroom looked so, you know, they were just beautiful, like very different from the white champignon that I, you know, this cooked version I'd seen on the pizza. And it also was like, you know, it's a very high risk situation. You can't eat a mushroom you're not sure of. You know, that required a precision of thinking and a different way of thinking about nature than I'd really brought to bear. I mean, even though I grew up in New York City, I was, you know, I'd gone to the Cub Scouts. My parents took us camping in the Adirondacks, and, you know, we could build a shelter, make fire, all that sort of, you know, basic nature skills. But then, you know, this was different. This was like, you know, knowing the mushroom was different than building a fire, because it forced a knowledge of the locality that was very different. And that was just a different knowledge. So I had to learn about the trees that were growing in the area that I was collecting in. And so I was like, okay, what are these trees? And I was like, oh, these trees grow in these soils and they don't grow past this point in the geography. And why is that? Well, because the geology is different underneath it. And the drainage is different and the water is different. And, you know, just it started, and then you have to pay attention to the weather. And then you have to pay attention to the rainfall in an area and when it happens and just all this other stuff that was there. And it gave a reason for looking at those stuff. And it was just like, find this tasty esoteric delight. So that was kind of like the beginning of it. And so it's just like, then it was like a puzzle or like a really interesting thing. And also like reading. Nature is projecting information all the time. And if you can track it, you know, I mean, that's what people who hunt or do collecting may call it, you're reading the environment. And I, you know, growing up in New York City, I learned to read graffiti.
An urban environment, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like there's a ton of information in graffiti that is obscure and looks like nature in a lot of ways. It's sort of like what's this blob of information that seems to be an aesthetic, you know, front. But like, if you look at it more carefully, you can decipher people are sending signals. People are telling you where they're from. People are telling you about different internecine or interterritorial battles that are going, you know, like there's just a huge amount of information and you can tell when it happened and you can tell stylistically who was influencing, you know, just like all this stuff. You know, hunting mushrooms was like reading graffiti. It was like, it's there if you can see it. And if you can't see it, you're just like, oh God, nature is confusing, and or it's pleasant, or it's threatening, or, you know, it's just like all these other stuff that we just impose upon it.
Like seeing graffiti for the first time can feel threatening and, or imposing. Yeah.
Yeah. And other people are like, wow, that's an amazing, look at this person's style. They really practiced for a while there. This is, you know, this is the hand of an artisan who did this. You know, you can find that amongst the trash, the beginner's work, or, you know, the neophytes and all that stuff. And you're like, ooh, this person, and you can see like, they learned that style from Philadelphia, or they spent some time in Brazil, because I can definitely see, or they're paying attention to Brazilian artists from this style that they're importing. You know, I mean, there's just like tons of nuance in human art, and particularly in the written form. That's something that humans do all the time. It's an expression of culture, very much so, is like those gestures of writing. And I also studied art. So like, again, like I was really open to looking at this, not as a threatening, you know, whatever. It was like, there are, you know, the arabesques and the florios in the stylization of, you know, the printed word are awesome in terms of art history and, you know, what we read into them. And it's like, it's not in the past. It's right now. It's right in front of you. Like, actually, you can see how Brazilian cursive style is mixing with Philadelphia influences on the streets of San Francisco. And it's like, this is not in an art history book. This is happening in front of you right now. It's just like, it brings the past. The past is not the past. The past is right in front of you. But it's difficult to see because you see it as trash or a threat. And anyway, very similar to mycology. And, you know, there's just tons of information out there and it's up to you to decipher it. Is that a disgusting dog vomity looking pile of stuff that's on that log? You might be averse to turn away.
And a negative tropism.
Because you have been indoctrinated within culture to not look at that thing or to associate it with something bad, dog vomit or whatever. Even the name of it is a
negative tropism.
Don't, right. Who wants to talk about that? You know,
I mean, the word fungus has become a negative tropism in its own way. Yeah.
So we don't look at it with the same openness to the experience. And myxomycota, that dog vomit fungus, which isn't even a fungus, it's, you know, it's a slime mold, it's another sort of colonistic entity, is amazing. And if you pay attention to it, it can be used as a supercomputer that can solve problems that our digital computers would take a trillion years to solve, and it can do it in like a minute. And you're like, well, maybe we should be paying attention to that. And being drawn towards it rather than being drawn away from it. Because it's actually like, if we do pay attention to it and are not averse to that information, we might learn a lot about the past and the future and how we might connect between those two if we get over our graffiti aversions.
Well, reading environments. I mean, that's something that's so uniquely human. And that process you're actually describing of being attracted to like an arcane, delectable morsel, and then you're going to start reading this, for you at the time was a novel environment. I mean, you're just like retracing the steps of primitive man as they found more delectable morsels and needed then necessitated understanding locality and geography. And it starts to get you to wonder about, you know, is that trait of being open to accepting new information like that, and when you're greeted with something novel, to not turn away, but to say, is there a language I can decipher? You know, that must be some trait of adaptability that kind of runs through successful humans over time.
Primitive man. I mean, this is the thing. It's like, we imagine that the future is going to arrive in some shiny metal spaceship or from a, you know, computer display screen. And that's what the future is going to look like, rather than it's going to look like that moldy clump in the forest. That might be the future. No, I mean, really, it's like, that might, and again, like that sounds a little disturbing and maybe a lot of disturbing to many people. But that is also like, so the future is not that far off. It's just, we don't see it because it's here with us. And that idea of almost time travel, it's like those people in the past are not primitive. They're way ahead of us in the future, actually. And, you know, we're trying to catch up to them in many ways, not like we've regressed or we've acceded to some height. That's a linear view of history that doesn't really serve us so great as far as being a student of history, because it's not linear. It's dynamic and circular, or not, you know, just occupies very different temporal structures than we kind of impose upon it by the ideas of getting better all the time. And that itself is a mythology that pushes this from seeing the future in the present. So the fine mycelium material that is going into our reishi product at MycoWorks, you know, the ways that I came across this was just observing mycelium as it grows in climax forests, you know, like old forests that have been around for over 100 years and have this diversity of big logs in the litter that are decomposing by these polypores, and finding sheets of mycelium growing within them. And so it was just like, hey, here's this naturally occurring phenomena, mycelium, which I knew of, and could see the polypores growing on the trees. So I could even identify what the mycelium, or had a good guess as to what the vegetative body of this thing that was sticking outside of the tree when it had fallen over. And then the wood had degraded to a point where I could pull it off. And there was like in the cambium layers, the layers between the rings where there's this high intensity of lignin, were sheets of mycelium, pure mycelium. I knew that this could happen in the phenomenology of the growing mycelium. And I was already starting to grow mycelium for reishi, lingshir, Ganoderma lucidum, for as a tonic, as an herbal tonic, as part of my things I was imbibing. And so I was like, huh, interesting. So I was like, I sort of have seen this phenomena growing in some limited set within the ways I'm growing mycelium, very crude DIY experimental kitchen. And so I was like, I could aspire towards this thing. I know that this organism can do this. It can grow in this way. And then I was like, here's the puzzle.
What is the tropism?
What is it doing? Why is it growing into this form? And that was for me a similar like unlock, like having to think like the mycelium and do all that stuff. But, and here's the amazing thing. Now MycoWorks is making this thing, like this new material on the planet. But it turns out that that's not true at all. And here at the Oakland Museum, some textiles were recently identified from indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest who were harvesting this very same exact sheet mycelium that I had observed and making artifacts that had been mistaken as leather or other things. And it's actually in this month's Scientific American. It's in the June 21st Scientific American, this reprint of this article, which looking under these textiles under a scanning electron microscope are like, no, these are mycelium. This is not leather. And there are two known artifacts in museum collections going back before into the 1900s. And so there are possibly, highly probably, many other textiles made out of sheet mycelium with no descriptions in the literature of this prior. You know, I mean, this is the problem. We have lost this information due to genocide and cultural destruction and loss of the continuum of this history. So it's like, is that our past? Is that our future? That's actually our past. So we are just reiterating a form that had existed on the planet and was known to be true, but was just lost knowledge. And so, you know, our future again is going to like, we don't even know what our past looked like, really. We don't even know what to look for in the past because we are blinded by the present and the ideas of what is possible. And so the concept of sheet mycelium, I would say, is probably by anybody who spends some time in the forest for some period and, you know, does that, will observe sheet mycelium and will start to utilize it. And in fact, there are anecdotal stories of people who do logging, finding sheet mycelium and using it as a styptic or as a bandage. You know, they would often get nicks and cuts from the saws and hatchets that they were using. very far away from, you know, provision to do so, but would use this sheep mycelium for the same thing. And this is also now an area of intensive research, is how to create biomedical products using fermented substrates. And again, like a folk knowledge, a wise woman's knowledge, wise person's knowledge that has been, is at the outskirts of our cultural acceptance, but is now working its way into the mainstream under different auspices and names to be accepted.
Yeah, new cultural packaging. And it seems very science fiction to think of wearing a living organism on your skin to heal you or something. It seems straight out of a science fiction novel. But you're saying we're really just pulling a concept from the past, and it's not about time. These are just concepts that human beings, when dealing with this environment, will kind of naturally come to. And that was the big question. I think a lot of people's narratives, like mine, mentally starts with, you know, Phil Ross, artist, developing relationship with Rishi. And you just told that story beautifully. But I guess for you, what was the thing that first drew you? Because now, obviously, Rishi is the focus of the MycoWorks Find Mycelium product at the moment. The Rishi, it's something that anyone who's seen your artwork, your various projects, you use Rishi or Ganoderma or those kind of hard polypore fungus. What first drew you to that in the infinitude of the woods and all the mushrooms out there? What drew you to that mushroom?
It was a bunch of things. I mean, I had observed them when I was out getting delectable, rare edible mushrooms. You know, it's like you get to know an area. You return to an area. You get to know your local grounds, you know, where you might collect wild types. And usually that's about accessibility. So you get to know your local environment. So, you know, go out and collect chanterelles and porcinis and, you know, all of the lovely, you know, Sparsus crispi, Ladypora sulphurus, and just like all the really yummy big mushrooms and that you find in plenitude. And there would be these, you know, polypores, these large, hard projections off the side of the trees, but they were like, you couldn't eat them, you know, so they were interesting, you know, they were just weird. Also, like I would appreciate them, but I was like, okay, well, you know, it's like, sort of like, but like also there's a cool rock, like, wow, that's a cool rock, you know, like it was sort of like in that category of right. things, you know, and I just like, again, like I was like taking it in, but I just didn't really have too much of a framework for other than like an aesthetic thing. Like this one is growing, this one is weird, or wow, this one is like got eaten by something else, or this one like grew in this really weird setting and it did this bizarre thing like that. And it's also just a very different relationship to how you look for mushrooms. Like when you're looking for edible mushrooms, generally I would say I fuzzily scan for the distance. Like I'm just sort of looking for cues of color or reflective natures or just other sensory inputs. And then I'm also kind of like looking down and scanning for patterns. And so it's like a very particular way, proprioceptic relationship to the ground. Like, how are you setting up? How are you opening up your senses? And you can't just be thinking about some other thing that's going to distract you. You're like, I'm smelling a slight, you know, you just have to be open as, you know, to the scent, you know, listening to your senses very carefully. And it's a full body thing. And then for polypores, it was like, I had to look up and it was just a very different visual. You know, you have the sky in the background. It was just like very different. When I wasn't paying attention. I didn't quite know how to. And it was like seeing some of these polypores being offered at the very first pot clubs in San Francisco back in the late 80s and early 90s. Who are serving clientele mostly who had HIV, was seeing these mushrooms being offered as a palliative or a health cure for people with diminished immune systems or people who had health issues. And so coming from the knowledge of traditional Chinese medicine, which did have uses for these things. So it wasn't just like, wow, these are just weird looking mushrooms. It was like, oh, wait, no, huh? Like these mushrooms are an herb that could be added to a tea. And it was just, you know, and, you know, HIV was opening up this wisdom in the West about immunoresiliency, which was not really a central tenet of considering how the body, you know, it was just not there. And so the idea that there were things that could stimulate your T cells, like, and that that was, that you could take that as a prophylactic, you know, you just take that every day as a tincture or as a tea, and that that might get your body's immune response to a different category. So when you do encounter problems, or when you do produce tumor-like cells, that your body can be better able to deal with them. And so that, that was just, and so Ling Shi, like, was being prescribed to people who had diminished immune responses. And it was like, what the, you know, because like there was no medicine. There was nothing. There was zero. There wasn't even palate. There were no things to even help your pain. These patients were not even, anyway. So it was like coming in from alternative culture. And so I was like, oh, I know those mushrooms. And then I was just like, wow, this is really different. Then it wasn't like thinking about the forest for food, but it was like thinking about the forest for medicine. And, you know, I was nominally engaging in, you know, collecting mint or yarrow or just, you know, the other sort of wild herbs I was familiar with that I might bring back to make an herb tea or whatever. Again, I was sort of like in the flavor realm as well with that. It was just like,
right,
nice herbal tea. I mean, you know, like in the West, you know, you can just have like a refreshing herbal tea that actually is serving a similar thing as a prophylactic, or, you know, again, like making your body generally healthier. Anyway, it just was like, huh, these are interesting, collecting these as medicine. And then it also just led into thinking of like, how does taking this mushroom help your health? And that opened it up. At that time in the late 80s, Paul Stamets had published, you know, his first book on growing gourmet and medicinal mushrooms. And, you know, so I was reading that. That really helped to think about my practicum, and also how to formalize my cooking into a lab. So it was really important to see, like, it was transitional seeing that book. I was imagining the, again, that gradient between the kitchen to the lab. And Paul also had a similar experience of like being in the wild a lot and just observing, and then having a practice inside. And, you know, for me, it was the kitchen. And so it's like that difference of like a really exacting thing where you have to learn health codes and cleanliness and cleaning all the time, like, you know, ABC, always be cleaning. It's the same thing for applied mycology or for any lab work. It's like you have to take that seriously. If you don't, you're not ready for it.
So would you say then Rishi were seminal in kind of pushing you into more of that applied mycology work, and suddenly you were seeing things beyond just the culinary and starting to transition to turning that kitchen bench into a science bench, kind of?
It was that, yeah. It was all very, you know, there was no like ABC or things happened and I was like, aha! It was just mixing it up. You know, it was like, oh, I'm cooking, and oh, I'm doing da-da, and oh, I'm going in the forest. And also, you know, I was an artist, and so I was like also making art. And eventually what often happens with artists is just like everything starts to blend together. And so it was like, well, this cooking part of my life is over here and this art part is over here, but then I'm really interested, you know, and I'm going out to the woods and doing this thing. And so it was like, then I started like growing reishi for its like health tonic benefits. And then it was like just observing how the reishi grew, you know, I was like, okay, this is like doing an exacting recipe, and I can cook this, and I can add my own knowledge of cooking to these recipes, like how to make foams and how to make mixtures and how to cool things differently, and just all this stuff that was like my own particular training. And then, you know, it was like observing how the mushrooms grew from a substrate, you know, transforming them from something like cardboard or sawdust or other agricultural byproducts into a mushroom was like, wow, this is a lot like the transformations of cement or plaster and other metamorphic mixtures that you learned, wax, you know, metal, like all this stuff is like, it's in one form. You have to change it. You often do this very particular things to it. And then it can solidify and become, you know, can become something different. It can have a one-way reaction, is what they call it in chemistry. And that's what, you know, that you, as an artist, you learn this stuff. That's part of your practical education, or at least the one that I received. And so I was like, oh, okay, you can cast this stuff like it is a metamorphic substrate that becomes a solid. And so it was like, okay, I'll just do it like that. And I knew about how to build molds, that is the forms in which you cast something within, like if you're going to make a plaster form or cement form. And so I did that. And again, it was like just, but there was also like a lot of years of practice building molds. It's not just, you know, it's definitely a craft. And so like I brought all these different things together and started growing mushrooms. And then it was just also like, I mean, the mushrooms, that thing going back to graffiti, like I thought they were really interesting to look at because they would change all the time. And I was like, that is amazing. Like it's even more so than plants. Like you can observe plants growing in time, and that's part of the magic of them, is like seeing how they react to their environment. And with mushrooms, it's faster and more intense. That, you know, the sensitivity is off the charts. And so I was like, this thing that I'm looking at, a lot of people find offensive, or they look away from it because, or they can't see it even. And that became a really interesting challenge to me. And also, I wanted to know, why aren't people looking at this? Why aren't people looking at dog vomit more often? People, come on. You know, it was like, no, I mean, it's a real serious question in yeah. aesthetics of like, why do we turn away? And it's not a natural thing to do so. It is an acculturated thing to do so. And so I was like, why do people gross? It's gross. And what is gross? And so I was like, oh, what is the bad? Why, what is the offensive? And so I was like, what is, you know, and gross goes back to the grotesque, and which is from the grotto, which is this underground area of things that have rotted and a place in the earth out of which things, you know, and then the modern version of the grotesque is, you know, this dead thing that's maybe separated from where it originated. And so it was like just really interesting to think about that stuff. And that started to tell me about a lot of other things too.
Culture, I mean, culture, the world of culture does not like the underworld. I mean, that's a common metaphor throughout story and everything else.
Yeah. And just, but it's also like, I mean, you know, if you're interested in fermentation, you're like, you're into the grotesque, you're into the grotto and the grotty and the caves and the underground and within the earth. And so it's like, but why is our culture turning away from that? Like, why do we think that's offensive? Why do we not want it? And it hasn't always been so in Western culture. Like it's had romantic conceptions before in the 19th century. And, you know, even prior to that, and in the form of gardens from the Renaissance, like the grotesque had a very particular educational form and, you know, is associated with Greek mythologies, you know, of the underground and of underground beings and trying to right. bring classical knowledge. But like, but in the 19th century, something happened of this idea that we are now turning away from and don't quite know how to bring back into the center. And so it's really interesting that fermentation is kind of doing that, of taking rotten things that are easy to digest physically, but hard to digest maybe mentally, into the center and elevate. How do you elevate the grotesque? Well, that seems sort of hard to do.
We all kind of know that undercurrent of mycophobia throughout Western Anglo culture. That's a common trope. And maybe it's tied to this. So as by far the more qualified anthropologist in this conversation, what did you discover? What made that switch in culture to kind of look at the grotesque as something to look away from when you're saying, actually, it may be a human trait that we would be kind of, or tropism to be attracted to something novel and grotesque and want to poke and prod it and all that kind of thing.
Definitely. Well, you know, like if you look into what we think is disgusting, like it's often at the line with delicious. So, you know, it's like a truffle or often our blue cheeses or natto. It excites us first. Mm. And then we decide, is that excitement run away or run towards? And, you know, it's how you're brought up often will define which way you're running. And so it's, you know, again, like this is like a, especially when we eat things that are so particular to a culture, we have to draw those lines. And so that is, again, like much more to do, like one culture will want to run away from blue cheese and one culture will run away from natto, though they are coming from a very similar root organism.
Wow.
That is creating those signatures. So, you know, it's that's cultural indoctrination as to what, you know.
It sounds like then part of your ethos in exploring this as a material, maybe some of the art you were creating, was to kind of play with that excitement response and kind of push people into the world of, you know, Phil's grotesque world.
Well, you know, my artworks are not for everyone, that is for sure. And they do play with that. You know, it is, they are supposed to be a little bit, you know, playing with that of like something you might not think of as beautiful, but it's really interesting though. And so it's even, and often the artistry is really obvious. Like it's, you know, like there's a lot of work to get the craftsmanship to a place where people can't just dismiss it as that dog vomit, but there's human intention is written into it. And so you're like, why would somebody do this? Or why does somebody like this? You know, or like it just sort of evokes those other questions. But, you know, I'm not trying to get everybody to do that. That's not, you know, that's a cultural agenda. That's different than people's tastes. And even towards our Bay Area centered aesthetics, which is towards maybe natural wood and bamboo, that is a very small minority of people who actually have that taste. And so going into commercial consideration of how you sell stuff, you know, when I was like, you know, we made products that were like made out of natural bamboo surfaces. And the advice we got, like, yeah, that's great. That's about 3% or less of the market. If you make that thing pink and shiny, we can sell more of it. Mm. And so I was like, do you want to sell people what they want? Or do you want to sell people what they, you know, what you want?
What
and,
you want. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not how capitalism works.
And does that explain the transition then? Because it's seeing your talks over the years, anyone in the Bay Area has seen the infamous mycelium wallets, but we've also seen the building blocks and construction materials made of mycelium. You know, how did you make this decision to kind of go in the direction? Because you're faced with this organism that can do incredible amounts of cool and interesting and novel things. And for kind of a blend of artists and scientists, you could go like 100 different directions and maybe that's on the horizon. But what pushed you toward creating something like fine mycelium and reishi? And there may be some obvious answers here, but I'm just curious to hear what kind of solidified that direction eventually.
Yeah, you know, there was no intention to do anything. I just want to clarify that for everybody here.
No direction.
With anybody who feels like they can get some wisdom from my path. I was like, yeah, just, you know, go, good Lord, help you all.
Yeah.
So, here's the quick 35-year way to get to your success, okay? If you just follow these three easy steps in 35 years, you could be like me.
That's the tagline.
It was really just, again, being open to observation and to what people want. So, you know, it was at first, it was like people were very much interested in how this might be used as a construction material, because through my art, I had demonstrated how you could form very hard and durable things that could be used as a building material. So then it was like, people were like, yeah, okay, well, what can you make out of it? And then again, it went through this process of like, well, do you make some nice looking piece of furniture in the hopes that people might want to buy it? And that's sort of like the design approach, but they didn't want to buy it. And then it's like, well, does this serve a need within industry where there might be, you know, interior architectural panel systems like you'd use for IKEA that can be grown with less water pollution, et cetera? No, there's not really a market for that. And it was like, so there is not demand for the, you know, there is interest, but there's not market demand. And also it's a lot, even though it's a very interesting topic for advanced governments, policy, building folks about how to reduce carbon emissions and make greener materials, there just are not markets. There's nobody making that. There is not demand for that. They're not people going out and saying, like, please take my money. I got to do this. Like, it's a small minority of demand, depending, you know, so getting people interested in the insulation panels in a home is not a really interesting.
Again, when you talk about tropism,
what do people turn to? Some people turn to that, but most people don't. Probably to a lot of your audience, it's very interesting because they're sort of, you know, you're pre-selected, you're in this minority here. But to a majority of the humans on Earth, they're just, you know, can I get it pink and shiny? And that's, you know, I mean, like, whatever. They have different things going on in their lives or different focus. So that's, you know, whatever. You just, that's the nature of reality. But then when we started to be asked to consider applications, you know, like things we could make to help industries in fashion, you know, starting with like shoe insoles, which are often made out of leather, and are the best insole you can get for your foot health. The synthetics are generally not great for your feet. So there's no organic. I did not know that. And so, you know, we were like, yeah, we can do that. I think it's like the price per leather insole is pretty good as far as like a little chunk of material that one generates. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then the more types of fashion things we were demonstrating, you know, or things for the fashion industry that we were capable of demonstrating we could create at MicroWorks from our fine mycelium process, you know, making sheet mycelium, too sweet, that there was just a much, you know, it was like the feedback loop was very clear. Like people were interested. And I was like, oh, of course, like people are really interested in fashion. Every human being is interested in what other people are wearing.
All back to tropism.
Humans are really interested. We're social beings. Like, you know, yeah, why aren't we looking at graffiti? You know, like, why aren't we looking at all the, like, we're looking at each other all the time. That's what, like, we're doing. And fashion is the rubric under which we get to look at people and talk about them and consider them and read them and write them and all this other stuff is in, you know, the things that we are second skins. It's like very obvious. And again, when you talk about like the future and the past, it's like, this is just like a human continuum. Like in fact, it defines us as human. In fact, is like when we find like, you know, our ancestors were making necklaces and stuff. And we're like, yep, human, you know, and you're like, okay, yeah, definitely putting feathers in their hair. That's a human thing. Oh man. Yeah. Very human. Still doing that. Yep. Still making beads and adorning ourselves. Anyway, so it was just like very obvious. This is what people wanted. And the acceptance, you know, that idea of like, how do you get people to accept the grotesque? It was like, where does a second skin? Like putting an animal skin on you is kind of gross, but it's also like, it is the height of human culture. Again, it's like the raw and the cooked. It's not just like, you're not like, jump on that animal and chew it up and then I'm going to wrap it around me. No, it requires sitting around a hearth and processing that with the whole family and using alchemical knowledge, you know, and chemical, early knowledge of chemical processing to get that into a durable, long-lasting thing. You know, that is absolutely through human, like an animal skin in the wild will quickly degrade. That's why you don't find them lying around in the wild all the time when you're mushroom hunting. It's like a good, delicious piece of nature that everything wants to eat. But humans, through smoking things and processing them and chewing them with the amylases in their spit and all these other things, you know, like whatever, all these amylase inhibitors and just like all this stuff that we were doing to the skins made them into a beautiful thing that we felt was worthy of standing in our place or acting as our face. Or, you know, if you are willing to wear it on your body, people will consider it. And in a different way than if you put it in your wall or on the ground or, you know, like, yeah, it's the same thing. Why, if you wear, like, how are you able to wear graffiti on your person? I don't know. I mean, that's sort of like a similar thing. Like, how do you make people consider your language or consider your what's the messaging? And fashion is a lot about that. It's a huge amount of transmission of messaging. And, you know, this is something I had no exposure to fine leather or luxury leather, really. It was just not in my area of interest too much. And as I learned about it, it really was how to transmit craftsmanship that has been passed along for hundreds of years. And those objects, for people who are trained to see it, they can be like, oh my God, that person is doing this technique that goes back to the same ways that we used to bridle horses and were able to demonstrate, you know, our capacities in all these other things. And like your handbag carries all those messages in it still. So again, it was just like, I did not know that, you know. It was just sort of more used to like, whatever, what the hell are, why are people so into this? And then I was like, oh no, this is like, again, like my own aversion or not unwillingness to pay attention. I was like, no, this is actually fine leather. Luxury leather is carrying this human practice down through the centuries from master to, you know, to student, hand to hand, of this way to process animal skins. The past and the future are right there. And so it's like, wow, it's been like it's not codified, written down information.
Really a mind-blowing insight. Obviously, I'm not a fashion person. Anyone could see that just by looking at me. But my wife is very much into fashion. It talks about how fashion's a form of communicating without speaking. But I had never thought of this idea. It's like a form of time travel, of conveying tradition and craftsmanship and physically wearing it. And you're also throwing out a concept that, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, clothing is something cultural. We really should all be kind of, maybe this isn't everyone, but we should really all be like running around naked like animals out in the woods. And it's like, no, but part of the thing that humans are attracted to, is clothing and adornment. That is something that makes us human. So in your meanderings, unintentionally, you discover that you can meet those needs and there is actually a market demand for it. And that ends up guiding your course a bit. Now, so then you're carrying on this legacy of craftsmanship. And as much as you can, talk about that process of turning reishi mycelium into something like leather. You know, I don't imagine you're tanning them, or maybe you are. But what does that transformation look like, as much as you can tell us?
Well, first, I just want to, there's no discovery. Like most women and non-cis, non-standard men know that fashion is an incredible transmitter of subtle informations. And a lot of guys are really dumb to understanding this wisdom or reading this as a significant part of human language. So I just kind of put that out there as to like, you know, there are certain
catching up.
Like even, and even within mycology, as there's this idea, like we all run around naked in the woods. And that's a very straight heteronormative kind of concept of like what's acceptable or agreeable as a way that one wants to present one's being to another. So I'll just say that in terms of like, you know, like how, what we all assume is like the best.
It's a very heteronormative male perspective.
But then that idea, but then going into that notion of transformation, it's also like, yes, fungal mycelium that grows in sheets, as observed in the wild, can be generated within industrial means to create fine mycelium, you know, like a form of mycelium you don't find in nature at anywhere. But in the process of turning that into this thing, like we do go through very much like a tanning process. And so this initial organic thing then has to go through, and this is a bad word, synthetic processes. What I mean by synthetic is like it takes a synthesis of different things that humans do. And so we are bringing different things. And so that can just be like tanning it, you know, using oak tannins or, you know, like other biological tannins to create different cross linkings or other sorts of stuff that happens between proteins, or to take out water or to hold water with what's called fat liquoring, which is a process of making a type of emulsion that has fats and non-fats mixed together that you want to kind of almost like putting a cream. It puts the lotion on the skin. Fuck. And so, you know, that's like the part of the process too of doing that. And, you know, so that's also, you know, that's part of the synthetic process. And then we're working with these tanneries in Europe that have created luxury, you know, have this history going back, you know, many, many years of creating and doing the physical processing and then the chemical processing to turn that into leather. Leather, that's a very general category. And as I sort of described before, like, you know, your dead animal could easily become your chicharrón or snack that evening if prepared in one way, or it could become an artifact that lasts for several hundred years if it has been, say, smoked and cured, or, you know, just like all these different ways of synthetically turning that into this human creation called leather. So it's really just sort of like starting as this medium. And so, like, if you own a fancy pair of shoes, and that's, you know, maybe just like a price category of leather shoes. And in the United States, that might be around $200 or more. That is, like, it was probably, a lot of it is made by hand. It's made with a high quality leather. It's made to last for a long time. It's like the lasting, the connection between the sole and the upper, the top part is made well, all that stuff. Anyway, that if that costs around $200 and up, the amount of chemical processing to that leather might be in the hundreds of steps, like to take that from an animal skin to turn it into that. So it is so far away from being a natural product, even though we associate it with animals, we associate it with, you know, all these other things of having a second skin. You know, when we do that, and also that craftsmanship that I just described, you know, that is part of what you're paying for, is to understand the quality of craftsmanship that went into that. I've learned a lot about leather. So there are performance leathers, like, which might be in your tool belt or your gun sheath or whatever, gun holster, knife sheath, or other sorts of, like a cowl, you know, like a ring for a horse or something, like, and those we expect to be very different from that $200 pair of shoes, and even more different than your couture purse, which is expected to last just as long, but has very different conditions under which it's supposed to serve. And so, again, the reason why the same animal can be turned into all these different leathers is through human knowledge of chemical engineering and mechanical processing and a lot of different things that come to bear to make this thing for us, which is, again, like based upon our desires that draw these out, and not always just utility. As, again, like I sort of described before, like, you know, I'm not vegan. I know that you are. I prefer to not use animal products wherever I can, but I've also learned that, you know, like animal leather insoles are the best thing for the health of your foot, because synthetic insoles do not create positive biotic conditions for the natural microbiota of your foot. And so it's like, maybe our product can do that someday too, using an organically derived. So it was just like, we have a lot of half-baked things that we've inherited because no one's really just thought about how to make it better. Or again, like with the advent of fast fashion, like we don't have shoes that we continually repair for 30 years. And you go to your local leather craftsperson who would understand that, you know, you have to use a goat skin for this part of it and a rabbit skin for this part of it. And, you know, maybe a calf skin for this part of it to give you the absolute utility, and would replace each of those parts of your shoe over a 30-year period. Like you would just have a continuum of shoe that would always be like, you know, you just kind of take it to your smith or to, you know, to the person around you who knew that, or even if you knew that leather crafting. But then again, like we don't have that. And now we have shoes with insoles that are not so great for your feet. You know, so like that's, again, like, are we getting better as we go into the future? Like, right. Nah, you know,
progress. Yeah.
I don't know. And again, it's like a lot of that is predicated upon just even having to wear socks, which are often having to do with working indoors a lot and with the modern city life. Like that's a new kind of, for a lot of people in the world, like that has led to differences in foot health now from encouraging certain microbiota of your foot to be expressed in environments that are not really, have not been adapted towards. Anyway.
That's incredible. You start exploring, of course, the microbiome of the foot. It makes sense that you would end up exploring all these different realms. Yeah.
Wherever you throw a rock, there is biology.
Yeah. Well, and when you're talking about that tradition of treating the same type of animal skin to different types of leather, is that the case with the fine mycelium? Are you starting with kind of your base fine mycelium created through a very exacting process? I would imagine special growing conditions, substrates, all of that dialed in to create, you know, maybe it's crosswalling or flexibility or whatever traits we're looking for. And then it's that same kind of craftsmanship, treatment, alchemy that turns it into different uses. Is it still too nascent to have really explored all those pathways yet? Or how does that work for the fine mycelium product?
Well, we can create a standard skin, and for different usages, there is usually a different measurement of that skin. So for luxury leather, it's usually around 3 centimeters or so, and then, millimeters, and three mils. And then, but then as you get up to performance, it can even go up to 10, you know, like a very thick leather. So it's like, and again, like they might be derived from the same animal, though one might have to have been split off or sanded down or might have to be pumped up with polyurethane. You know, like there's just like all these different ways that, so we can make a standard mycelium, but then the thing that is blowing the minds of our commercial partners and clients is that they're like, oh, but could we have it 5 mil? And we're like, yep. You can just add, you don't have to create that from a starting organism that does not have any standardized anything and machine it down or otherwise process it. But it's like, you can just grow it to that measure. And similarly, like you can make it tougher, softer. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we can do in the biology, which then can, you know, in the post-processing into the mechanical and chemical engineering afterwards. And in fact, you know, we can just, maybe people are imagining, oh, this is some ecological replacement for leather, but that's not really the appropriate way to think about it. It's a different category of sheet polymer. And that is the reality of it. And we can accept it as a close analog to something like leather, because it is a skin of an organism and it can be trained or engineered to have structures that are very similar to animal skin cell structures and to perform physically like this, you know. So it's like, so then we're like, oh wow, so this is a lot like that other thing. And, you know, and that's comfortable and acceptable and all that stuff. But then like, the mind-blowing part is that, like, no, you can actually determine what you want and then grow it to those things. And that's just really different than deriving it from an animal stock, you know, like a bunch of millions and millions of different animals and selecting it out, or also from petrochemical engineering, which is like a very different way of creating a sheet textile, like a polymer, you know, like some textile, neoprene or sheet, you know, any of sheet plastics we're familiar with. And this is like, no, you can actually grow sheet polymers to the qualities you want with conditions that are ready for their post-processing when they're done, and do them in a way that is suited to your local environment. You know, you don't have to use these intensive energy inputs, you know, amount of energy that you're using to create those conditions. And with, say, you know, sheet polymers derived from fossil fuels, like that takes a lot of heat, tons of engineering, lots of chemical transformations, you know, just like there's a lot of, a lot of energy that is going into making those polymers to synthesize, you know, to derive those polymers from the beginning, you know, the crude polymers that it has to be derived from. And this way you're actually generating them, synthesizing them via the mycelium. That is very ancient and very new.
Very ancient and very new, and is seemingly ready to absorb elements of industrial structures, processes, infrastructure already in place and use them in this new field. And I like how you kind of separated it as kind of a separate discipline of sheet polymer creation. This is not something necessarily that's a total analog or replacement, though I tend to think of it when you start talking about this stuff. I'm like, oh, I would never use polymers derived from oil again. Obviously, you said I'm vegan. I don't want to use cow leather. So in the future of this field or this industry, do you see that expansion, you know, some huge expansion adopting infrastructure already in place as possible? Or what does that future look like? I mean, are you guys able to keep up with the demand? I guess map out that trajectory of this industry as you understand it from someone, one of the only figures kind of on the inside of this budding ancient future technology.
You know, we rely at MicroWorks on, we rely upon the kindness of strangers to help us out quite a bit. You know, now we are what they call scaling, that is increasing the size of our production, making a larger scale of what we're doing. We have moved into a factory, you know, or built, not moved into, we built out a factory in Emeryville, California, across the bay from San Francisco. And that's, you know, about 40, 50,000 square feet or so. And that's a pretty big facility. It's like a half a city block and very different from the tiny studio from which it started. But we're already planning and looking towards that million square foot facility that we have to build next. And like we just moved in and it's like, oh my God, now we have to build something 20x, 20 times the size of what we just are starting to figure out. And that has to follow a logarithmic double. You know, we have to figure out how to double one factory, turn it into two factories, 2 million, you know, 2 1 million square factories, then has to turn into four, one, you know, and it just logarithm, like you're going to be doubling that. And it's a big industrial thing to make a facility that large. It takes a couple of years to do that, at least under the best of conditions. I mean, we have a very robust process that we've figured out that has, you know, we eliminated many of the risks of scaling up, or have, you know, kind of minimized those. So it is, you know, we've can convince people and, you know, people to give us money, people to help us do this, all this other startup stuff, that it is actually feasible. We have people who are willing to buy the stuff that we will generate from that million square foot facility. And so that, again, like, they will buy it if we grow it. And that's, you know, that's great. And so that gives, you know, a guarantee of this actually continuing on. But that means like, there's a lot of work ahead for many, many, many years to get this world. And it's a long-term process. And so I think like people want really fast, quick things, you know, because there's a lot of dire pressing issues, but we have to commit to this idea of things taking time. And we're not used to that as a culture of planning ourselves towards that stuff. So I'm not, you know, we are dancing as fast as we can. A lot of it is, you know, it takes a lot of money also. So it is just, you know, and that is risk. It is risky. No one's done what we've done before. So as much as people are behind this and doing all that, it is still, this is why we are in Silicon Valley working with venture capital, because those are folks who will take those sorts of risks, and not governments and not the consumer and not a lot of other folks. So that is definitely like able to happen as a result of that here in this neck of the woods. I mean, it's different in other parts of the world where there are different funding apparati to get those large sums, but it's like a lot of money to invest in this stuff. And that requires getting people who are comfortable with that. And, you know, again, building trust and building, you know, validating all this stuff and testing it all. And you know, that it's not just a, you know, a good story, but it is like third parties are testing these materials. And yes, it is at least as good as, if not better than, animal skins. So people will use them for these industries. And that is just, that's taken us 7 years to even just validate that. So that's like, you know, so for all y'all just starting out right now, it is not, you know, don't jump into it and start a business unless you know someone's going to buy it, because you will be out of business really fast. So take a long time and lay low and see what people want. And not just the people around you, because they might want bamboo or natural wood, but like go talk to those people who want the pink and shiny and find out what they want and how you can provide it to them. know? So it's like, that's the kind of bridge, you know, it's like, why aren't people doing, well, why aren't you making something people want? So we can't rest on our righteousness and expect people to come and eat the broccoli they don't want to eat. You know, they're not going to get down with that gross thing unless you like put some Szechuan sauce on that broccoli and, you know,
make it palatable.
Yeah.
Well, and you can go on Instagram and see the reishi, the fine mycelium reishi, and it looks glamorous. And you start thinking, I want to make this, but clearly this has been a 35-year journey of exploring, 7 years of proving a product. For you, what has that transformation process been like for Phil Ross, artist, anthropologist, chef come scientist, to then have to navigate the world of Silicon Valley VCs and proving out a product and industrial processes and building factories? I mean, I imagine it necessitates building a team, but what has that transformation process like been for you?
How has this been a transformation for the artist come industrialist, fundraiser for in Silicon Valley?
Tycoon.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the co-founders of MicroWorks, Sophia Wong, you know, we always talk about this as a rendering process. That has been what it's been like, because Sophia also, you know, had a PhD in epic poetry. So it's like we both came to bioengineering fully prepared. But both of us were highly practiced in storytelling and moving amongst subcultures and validation of subcultural values within academic realms of citation and historical relationships and all that sort of thing. So when we really started towards the commercial process, you know, of forming the company and encountering cultures that we were not very familiar or comfortable within, we realized, you know, that we couldn't come to it as artists, like with our own values or with our own precepts of what a business should be like. But that we were going have to be emissaries, ambassadors, or travelers into this foreign land. And you can't just be an accepted guest if you go somewhere and tell people they're offensive and you don't like their culture. You know, that's just, it ain't how it works. So
right.
We were like, we have to come as ambassadors and with a willingness to learn new things and to change parts of ourselves to communicate and to understand, you know, so that they can understand our values and we can understand theirs, and, you know, where to meet and where to build trust is really the thing. I mean, that's, again, like a lot of people throw that out, but it's absolutely true. And was part of that long process, that 7 years, was like, how do you trust people? How do you know to trust people? Like, who do you trust? And you have to trust strangers in order to form a business or to expand in the world. You have to accept the wisdom and trust of strangers. And like, that's hard for anybody, anywhere. And so Sophia and I really talked about it as a rendering process. Like, we were going out to have to take those things that we considered vital and essential to our own nature, and we might have to watch them as they melt and turn into a different form and maybe melt away, but also, you know, like following the fungus, like maybe melt and be transformed into something more valuable or more interesting, or dissipating the toxins. You know, I don't know, whatever the metaphor is, you want to lay on top of it. And so it's just been a continual rendering process. It has not been easy. And certainly starting a business, it's a high wire act. Like, if you're comfortable getting on a wire between two buildings with a gust of wind and no net below you, great, man. I'm not that kind of individual. So that's harrowing. And like, if you fall, you're going to die. Like, that's, and you might kill everybody who's invested their retirement funds.
Yeah. So like a high wire act, everyone's life is on your performance.
Well, it's not so, I mean, it's not really, you know, that's a bit histrionic, you know, but it is truly, I mean, like, you know, it was like friends and literally friends and family. So it's like people who are taking their retirement, like, yeah, I was putting this away in my retirement fund, but I believe in you and this company, and here's the money. And so it's not just like, yeah, haha, if we fail, oh well. You know, it's like, oh my God, I took down someone. Like, that is the risk. And so anyway, that is like not for everybody. I don't know if it was for me either, but like, that's the sort of thing. But it's like, to paint it all as like grand successes or like a glorious pathway, that is often the narrative we like to tell post haste. So it is challenging, and it's, you know, I'm in my 50s, so I'm not like as nimble in my mental things or habits to constantly be adapting. And it continues to still be a lot of storytelling, as right here with you, like that's a lot of it. And so it's been storytelling, and even within that, there are different ways to tell stories. Some of the stories are told with technical data. Some are told in metaphor. Some are told, you know, through other people now, magazines or fashion, you know, just like it is a meme. It is memed out. And so that has been a big part of it. So, and as one of our first employees, employee number one at MicroWorks said, you have to have a stomach for it. And so like, if you've ever been on a ship that makes you nauseous, like, you know, it's like, sometimes it takes a commitment of working through nausea for months before you get your stomach for it. And some people are just like, nope, I'm never going to go fishing again, man. That's horrible. Like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, year one or two, when you start hitting some of those roadblocks, I'm sure for me, there'd be the impetus to like, you know what, I'm going to drop this and do something else that's fun.
Well, the great thing is, you know, that's different than being an artist in general, which is very isolating and individualistic, heroic position that artists are, you know, it's like, it's even though you're about organizing community, you're sort of like often on your own. And then the interesting opposite or antipode, you know, on the other hand, is a corporation, or a group, which is many people acting as a singular body. You know, that was just a really interesting concept. And so it's not me. You know, I mean, there are over 100 people at MicroWorks now, and all of them are doing really important stuff. And, you know, I have this small role to play within that. And, you know, again, I'm thinking about the future past, and I'm thinking about very specific cellular organizations of the mushroom, because that's what I do well, you know. So, but then we have all these other people who, you know, are familiar with luxury goods. And, you know, that's part of what we have to do. And, you know, it's not, again, it's like, I've had to be open to that and to things that I did not really have reception. Like in the same way some people are put off by graffiti, like I was put off by luxury handbags. I mean, I just was like, I'm not going to look at that. I just don't want to look at it. I had an idea about it and I was like, nope, it was not there. And then I was like, someone would explain it to me, or craftspeople who I could relate to, you know, it was like leather craft, or, you know, just like artisans who had trained for a couple of decades on something. And I was like, I can really listen to them. I heard them. And I was like, I had to be open to that. And it was definitely part of my growing process. But your growth will happen along offensive lines, going back to the grotesque. So open yourself up. Open yourself up to the... Stay with the difficulty. Stay with the problem.
Face the grotesque. Face the difficulty.
Stay the difficulty. You know, it's like 10 years is hard. Stay with things that maybe offend you a little bit. Stay with people who are, you know, like are doing things that you're not necessarily so keen on because of one of your belief systems. And, you know, that's also in this day and age, very encouraging, is that wherever I go to talk about mycology and fashion, it's very international. You know, you can talk to folks about those things in a way that can be outside of specific politics. And because it's like a lot of it comes into craftsmanship and locality, which you would actually think would sort of like be against this, you know, like people getting along and talking together. But it's actually a really interesting way for us to converse about our differences. And to talk about the regional specialties, like, whoa, where I collect mushrooms is like this, or I learned this about my local ecology. And then people are across the globe are like, wow, tell me more about your local ecology. Like, that's really different than this politicized thing. They're like, ah, get your people out of here. We don't like what you do and who you are, and, you know, that sort of thing. And so these edge areas, you know, these kind of grayer areas, like what is fashionable? What is attractive? What is interesting? What is gross? And also like, you know, what is mycology? You know, who knows? And so there's a nice overlapping there of like being able to speak to others in these difficult areas, because, you know, it takes a certain dedication to reading the graffiti to reap the rewards.
And it's a seemingly universal human interest is in that locality and differentiation that comes from that. So there's kind of a universal nature to an appreciation of the local. Well, I mean, you just elucidated some really huge, mind-blowing concepts that we can all digest, but to hit with an easy question, the obvious question that everyone wants to know, where can we get it? Where can we get MicroWorks Fine mycelium products, or what does that pathway to the consumer look like for you guys at this point?
Well, I think the best way to keep on top of this is to track our social media. We will be launching products with a bunch of different partners. I believe some of them will be happening within the year. And you can, again, like see some of the folks we've already announced our partnerships with, Hermes being one of them. And so I think you can go to Hermes and put in your pre-order. But aside from that, I can't really disclose that much other than to tell you that there is a lot more on the way. And we are also ramping up our production as fast as we can.
So there will be lots and lots more mycelium polymer on the way. Mycelium leather.
Absolutely. There will be fine mycelium reishi materials are in the works. It is happening. I mean, it's so nice that it's actually transitioned from like not being able to tell, like we've had to keep secrets for years. It's so hard. We've seen these remarkable, beautiful things that our partners have made. And I can't even tell anybody about or show them a picture of it. It's just the word, like talk about esoteric secrets. Like I didn't imagine this would come to bear on my life to like see something and just like mind-blowingly beautiful consumer items made from our materials, MicroWorks materials. And I can't wait for everybody else to be able to see them too.
Well, we're all excited for that secret society of the mycelium leather to open up and show us all the wonderful esoteric secrets therein. No, I know so many people have seen the materials, are mind blown, super, just by the look of the reishi material. You can't believe that that's not already some kind of animal leather. So I know so many people are excited. And I know New York Fashion Week just this past year debuted some different items and gave us a little taste, a little flavor. So I know I'm really excited to see what's on the horizon. And to open it up to a little more broader question, because you've talked about the company, some about this field, you know, maybe putting on our science fiction hat for a second, what is the future of mycelium materials? I mean, this field, this technology, and maybe this is just a cheap way for me to start talking about the moldies, but what is the future? What is the future of mycelium leather, mycelium second skin technology?
Well, it's an interesting question. What is the future of sheep mycelium? And I will tell you a story. So there is an author, a science fiction author I really like and was influenced by called Rudy Rucker. He is here in the Bay Area as well. And he wrote a 4-book series called the Wear Tetralogy. I think it was like software, hardware, firmware or something. So I forget what it was. And he, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, a cyberpunk was, you know, sort of coming on as a genre. He conceived of this thing called ribofunk, which was this biotechnological future, which is very different from this sort of like computer interface things, but like how would we interface with biology? And so I read these books, and within one of the books, he describes this relationship that human beings develop with the sheep mycelium fashion that they've developed, and kind of taking it a little bit further than where we are right now, that this would actually be a living organism that you would have, you know, maybe you put it on. It wasn't exactly clear how you actually adopted this thing. Maybe you put it on like a lotion, but it was really existing as this thin layer of mycelium on the outside of you that was incredibly sensitive to your body. You know, it was like it would modulate between you and the outside environment, you know, between toxins, or help you to generate food or keep you warm, or even go out into space wearing it. You know, it could become like your spacesuit, and just like a remarkable technology, but also then to become these very intimate partners for humans, such that this you know, some people just like remove themselves from human culture and really just form this intensive bond with their my second mycelium skin. And they were called moldies, this category of humans, the moldies. And so, you know, I was like, yeah, right. This is awesome. And in fact, like in the formation of MicroWorks, like when we were trying to figure out the name of it, you know, one of the things I was like, oh, we have to call our company Moldy, like MOL-D or period D, like Moldy. Cause yeah, we're making that future real. And like, it was like one of those matters of taste where the other people voting were like, nope.
Business advisors are like, no, no, Phil, sit down.
Yes. That learning to grow thing is like, yeah, nobody wants to buy that, you know?
Right. Oh, I mean, that's just like this far out vision. When you first told me that story, I knew we needed to get it in here because that is like the hyper futuristic. Eventually, we're just going to be wearing second skins of mycelium. And I mean, some people kind of already are moldies. You know, they grow their mushrooms in their house. They listen to or they make podcasts about mushrooms. They talk about mushrooms. They Instagram. I mean, basically have already forsaken human society to dive into the world of the mycelium.
Have a particular Asco Basidio smell signature coming off of them. Yep. Yep. I know the type. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well, I am excited to see that ancient future come real and see how we are able to manipulate biotechnology. And you've given us kind of a hint at what that can look like. So
I'd also just interject too. I mean, it's like, you know, this is again, like not anything we intended to do, but growing things with mycelium is a really positive way for humans to consider our relationship with industry. And, you know, I don't know if it's really so much like get back to nature, but it's like maybe get back with industry, you know, like that's actually, it's not, we have to put our focus there. Like, yeah, we do have to be in the forests and learning lessons, but like, we can't use that as just the escape and imagining like, oh, this will save us from these machines. You know, again, it's like, that is the challenge is like, we have to bring the forest to the machines. You know, so we have to pay attention to our industrialization and not away from it, or imagine that it's like going to come from some more hobbit-like existence, because that's just not how modern reality is conformed for most humans at this point who live in urban conglomerations. And so that is the projection for our reality. So it's like we have to green our cities, we have to green our industries, and mycelium-based technologies are an awesome way to start to consider that, or a small part of how we're going to do that. And again, it's like part of a much larger arc. And when people are interested in like, what do I do? How do I get into this? It's like, you can get into it in whatever form you want to. If you think about it within like a 5 or 10 year plan, it's like, how am I going to introduce mycelium into X part of the world? And like, man, that's an awesome puzzle to figure out. Cause like in 10 years, you can figure it out. But it's like, it's not going to happen tomorrow. But like, you know, that is where the future is like, you know, a lot of people putting a decalogue into this seriously. It's not just going to come from industry. It's not going to come from your government. It's going to come from a lot of people just doing it.
A powerful insight. The hobbit-like existence is something I'm heavily invested in. You just kind of flipped that on its head.
It's okay.
And said that the urban conglomerations, you know, people coming together and forming these coral reefs and having craftsmanship and industry is something that's part, inexorably at this point, part of the human experience and the human existence. And we need to combine that with this increasing infinity of biology that we're discovering. And I love how you just brought that up too, about how having that question or that drive is awesome. Know that there's probably going to be a 10-year period to bring it into fruition, but that's something else that you and I talked about before, and it might be too expansive a conversation to get into, but that importance of starting when approaching this infinity, especially of mycology, but biology in general, you know, microbiomes of the foot, microbiomes of everything, you know, you have to have a question that really starts guiding you through that infinity, right?
I think so. I mean, it's just, it's so vast. And I think the same way of going back to that idea of trophic, like what is attracting you? Like what is drawing you in? And I mean, for me, again, initially it was food, and then it was medicine, and then it was just art and materials. And then it was like performing materials for industry. And now it's like about fashion. And, you know, and it's like, these have all been really, I mean, they're interesting enough to me. You know, it's like, I am interested in how buildings are built. I'm not, you know, again, it's not my life, but I have enough interest in how stuff is made. And so that was enough. And again, it's like, I'm not a natural born fashion type, but I am interested in culture and art and craft. And there were some fashion designers I really liked and interested in. And so again, it was like a way to explore that. And I just didn't really think mycelium would be the pathway towards doing that, or wouldn't even consider it. And so I think it was just like that openness towards it. And it's an interesting thing. Get into it in the way that you can get into it. And, you know, for an urban person like myself, it was like food was definitely a way. Even with that, it was like I could ferment in my kitchen. Like I learned making pickles in New York City. Urban people do a lot of fermentation. Kimchi is a highly urban practice. Like you go to parts of Asia and people have balconies full of cabbage wrapped up for their urban transformations they're going to do. So it's like the forest and hobbits report to the mist. You know, it's good. We need that hobbit knowledge, but it's like, it's not like against the urban ideals. It's actually with the urban ideals, you know? So it's not like, oh yeah, you know, if only they could have been more like us, then we could find equanimity and peace in the world. No, it's like, yeah, bring your hobbit self down to the graffiti show and show us what you got. You know, I mean, it's like the same thing. And
yeah,
and all you graph writers get into the woods and start to decipher mushroom tonality. You know, it's just like you can get into it however you want to get into it. There's a lot of ways. And so I just think like that's like there's always a way in. There's always a way in.
And, you know, maybe it's elucidating the obvious, but I think so many times we're faced with this like infinity of mycology or just biology and all the new understandings coming out of that. It's kind of like, what do you do with it? And it's nice to know, and just hearing you speak about it, it's nice to know that just following the interests that most draw you in based upon your own position and cultural background, going after those things and kind of going into the infinity and pulling things that you could use to follow your own passions, that's an okay as a direction. You know, it doesn't need to be a divine direction. Well, once I have the entire image of what this means, then I can decide where to do what. It's like, no, it all starts from following what you desire to explore the infinitude of biology. And that's totally okay. And maybe I'm the only one concerned about that, but I've heard that from people. Like, I don't know where to start. There's way too many cool things to explore. It's like, well, go with what you're interested in and you'll be guided on some kind of path.
Yeah. I think just be patient. I listen to the mushrooms. I know that sounds like, you know, kind of quasi mystical or whatever, but you know, but that's the closest thing. It's like, you know, I keep on trying to pay attention to them and they keep on drawing me into interesting areas that then give me a way to think about it. So I think like, yeah, you don't have to know everything. You don't have to even know hardly anything at all. And no, really, I mean, because none of us do, it's too vast. So the little bit that you understand or decipher might be really important for a lot of other people to hear. And again, like, because it'll start to point out other stuff along the pathway that people can follow and find wayfinders in this vast universe of things that are significant and meaningful. And that will happen by humans inscribing and making those meanings. And again, it's like, coming up with a tastier dish, like an interesting way to make stuff. Like that's all really interesting and just starts to provide it. I, after being with mushrooms for 35 years, am just getting to thinking about, the microbiome, like these very sexy words right now, microbiome. But like, you know, yeah, you can put that up for 30 years too. That's fine. It won't affect any of your thinking or knowledge at all. You don't have to, you really don't have to. There's so much other stuff you could focus on in regards to it. So I'm finally coming, you know, like I'm interested now in fungal genomics, you know, like the genomes of fungus and like, you know, protein experiments, very weird things. But like that was very far away from my reality for a long time. I knew it. It was kind of like, oh, that sounds cool. Or complex, or I don't get it, you know, or whatever. But it was fine. It's fine. I mean, it's sort of like just Montaigne, you know, the French essayist. Montaigne, you know, like he was a sort of a very modern intellectual, and just being like, you know, if you read something and it seems too difficult, you can just blow it off. It's okay. Like, you know, I mean, it's like, take the part that you get. And like, if it seems to, you know, it doesn't make you any more of a dummy, and you don't have to work over it forever to be like, oh God, why am I not as smart? You know, and he's like, you know what? It's okay. It's cool. Like, you can come back to it maybe if you want to. It's fine. There's no, you know, it's like less of the stoicism of like, you're a failure because you're not receiving the knowledge. You're not good enough to receive this holy knowledge, you idiot. You know, it's like, not like that, but it's like, Montaigne had this like a little more relaxed human kind of thing. Like, you know, I'm busy. I'm distracted. What's fungal genomics? Oh man, God. Oh God. I got, you know, I have to get dinner or the kids, whatever, you know, fungal genomics. Oh, and then it's just like, right. You know, all that. And then it's like, it's okay. It's fine. Just like, you know, just don't, you don't have to chill about it. You can just enjoy eating mushrooms for as long as you want to. And that's fine. Totally fine.
It's all okay. It's all going to be okay. And you're going to make meaningful, great contributions and be happy.
You'll connect to other people. And that's just the other thing. Like, that's really what it's about. You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, mushrooms are fascinating, but they're fascinating because they're fascinating to other people too. And it just enters into our lack of knowledge as humans. And a way to talk about that comfortably, going back to Montaigne, it's like, yeah, we're all kind of dummies in this field, and it's fine for all of us to move on a bit. And it's much more allowing in all these other parts of our life where we have such stringent expectations of like what is true and what's right and all this other thing. And like, it's so relaxing to just be like, you know what, I'm just going for a walk in the woods, and here's this weird thing, and look, you step on it, it does this bizarre thing. Hey, did you know that you could, this one will kill you. You know, that's cool. That's a good story. Things that kill you make good stories. Like, for, that's all the kids talk about all the time. You know, it's like, so.
Well, and then you throw it under a microscope. Oh, that's cool. That looks great. Yeah. You don't have to know everything about it to still appreciate it. And
you can just look at stuff under a microscope because it looks interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Like, that's totally okay. You know, like, you don't have to have a, you don't have to be looking for anything other than cool stuff. And the microscopic world offers a lot of that. And that's totally fine. It's the same as like looking at your window and drawing what you see there. You know, and how much of a relationship do you have with those cows in the field? I don't know. Like, you know, but you're drawing them. So
we can't make qualitative assumptions about the pleasure, joy, interest someone derives from something based on their level of understanding from it. Like, it's perfectly valid. This has been very reassuring for me, and I'm sure many amateur mycologists, coming from someone who I'm not going to deem an expert, but has such a deep and long arc relationship with fungi, that it's all okay. Follow your interests.
Okay, yeah. Follow.
It's going
to
be great.
Follow your interests. You know, learn from people who are difficult to learn from. Learn things that are difficult to learn, or, you know, adopt to, you know, even just in the consideration of what a new language is. You know, I failed Latin. Now I have to use Latin all the time. Oh man, that was a harsh lesson. My high school teacher was right. This was going to serve me well. I'm big enough of a person to admit that now.
You've clearly grown and transformed. Clearly, much growth and transformation. Well, you know, usually I wrap up the show with three different questions, but I think honestly, for the bulk of them, kind of about the future and how fungi have changed you, we've already really gotten the answer throughout. So I'll just ask the question of, and maybe we'll make it two, and I'll throw another one in here inspired by yourself. But the first one is just another mushroom or fungus that you love and why. I would say something other than Ganoderma. Maybe it's something you want to blow our minds with, something that you just like to eat, whatever. But a mushroom or fungus you love and why.
What is one of my favorite mushrooms? Well, I really think it's interesting. Lenzitas betulina, the guild polypore. And so this is, you know, polypore is a mushroom that generally has these little teeny pores, little holes in the bottom of them. And in this one, you know, it looks like a typical one that would grow up the side of a tree. But then if you look underneath it, it has gills. So it is in this description in the nomenclature as being a polypore, many pores. But then when you key it out, when you use the Latin and you look at it, it has gills. So I think it's really great. And there's a description on mushroomexpert.com by Michael Kuo about this. And it says, and the name of this very short essay, which I recommend everybody read, is "What, if anything, is a guild mushroom?" And it goes into this description of some of the things that we were, you know, getting on here of like, you know, understanding something. And so this is a category buster. And just it talks to this thing called convergent evolution as to the ways that gills on a mushroom actually come into being, which are, they're sort of like a habit of mushrooms and the ways that they express this organ of their body. And that same as like a tree is a habit of plants.
Ooh, a kind of a form.
It is a possible expression of the growth of plants, but it is not a thing itself, but it is just a way that that growth conforms to the world. That kind of had me thinking a lot about biology, about form.
Where do those blueprints come from?
Just about, and also like how even like in mycology, where like these physical descriptions are very important for understanding what is poisonous, what's not, what is the mushroom that you're actually looking at. And even within those categories, there are these exceptional ones that destroy that whole ordering system. And so, you know, as a student of history or of knowledge making in general, like that's really interesting. And it kind of pointed, as they do in like a lot of scientific structures, like where those aberrant things, those things that don't quite fit in, kind of point towards a greater organizing structure. And now that we are starting to do classify mushrooms along genetics and genomics, we understand how gill forming happens and that it is not in the genetics per se, but it is, you know, a way, a form of possible expression of making a surface area. And that starts, you know, we have to look at like Alan Turing and, you know, pattern generation from information and other areas to actually understand this. And so it gets really interesting in terms of developmental biology and other stuff that is, you know, like, why is this polypore have gills? And it just starts, it unlocks a fractal, a literal fractal universe understanding of how the world looks the way it does. And so it's just like, it just kind of like, it got, you know, it got me into looking at Turing patterns and developmental systems and emergence of pattern, you know, like of all the stuff that's really interesting and how we recognize mushrooms that have to do with not just the biology, but like, you know, how matter itself and how the universe is organized comes through into those things. I mean, it happens in all biology, but it was just like a remarkable way to tap into this knowledge of geometry and information.
That projects what potential forms are going to manifest in the world. I mean, really some...
Well, convergent evolution often has to do with the environment. You know, like the environment itself sets a criteria by which evolution happens within. I mean, this is the whole thing with the misunderstanding with bioengineering or biotechnology. It's like it always happens within an environment and the life on Earth happens within the environment of Earth, which is constantly changing. And so how does life make something to deal with a constantly changing world and keep on going? And it's with these adaptive patterns and adaptive ways of being in relationship to those physical constraints. So gill forming is a habit based upon gas absorption, like all sugar, you know, like all sorts of other stuff. It is constrained by the physical reality, same way that ichthyosaurs look very similar to dolphins, look very similar to sharks, even though evolutionarily they came from really different roots, but they all assume the same form because there's a hydrodynamicness that defines the biology and it optimizes towards that in the same ways that gill formation is just about spatial organization or pore formation or other Turing expressions of like how to maximize surface area within certain fractals. Like that is just the constraint within our physical reality.
Well, and we know that in mycology, mushrooms and fungi challenge the notion of an individual, but man, does that challenge the notion of individuals, that there are biomorphic kind of blueprints or potential expressions based on environmental factors that may be shared across species and different, I mean.
We assume the form. I mean, an ichthyosaur's biology is really different from a shark, is really different from a dolphin, but the outside shape is defined by hydrodynamic constraints with a biology based on blood and other, you know, like other things define that really differently. I mean, that's why gelatinous creatures have very different forms, you know, because they're also adapting.
Those constraints and those organic mechanisms come to the same forms. Insanely interesting.
Yeah, evolutionary development is this area of biological, you know, study, which has to do with this, of how the genomes are reacting with these things in a shifting environment, and then these physical constraints. You know, it's like how does that, again, like biology doesn't happen in a vacuum. Genetics don't happen in a vacuum, but they are based on the physical reality that they are adapted towards. And so, to kind of consider all those things together. It's like, it's hard because you have to think about environment. You have to think about chemistry. You have to think about like the development of genetics. You have to think about the expression of genetics, you know, just all this. It's hard. And so Evo Devo is thinking about these things. And there's a lot of, you know, people do this in Carl Niklas in plant biology, and it was really famous in the 80s describing this. There's a lot of other people who've done this. And then people thinking about this critically, like Susan Oyama with like a book like Evolution's Eye, or the McMenamins with the book Hypersea, of just, you know, like thinking about how geological development along with biological development, along with all these cofact, you know, like how do they, again, it's hard, and we don't have great frameworks or ways of transmitting this data to people holistically. Like it's.
And that's when we start moving our hands around.
Absolutely. Or blame it on purple energy. It's one of the two.
I'm always for that. I'm always to blame it on magical energy sources that keep everything in motion or have some blueprint that everything's conforming to, even though it's probably much more complicated than that. Well, Phil, of course, you left us with a huge concept to explore right at the end. I think it's a perfect place to wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing insights, sharing your own personal journey, being really generous with your time. You know, you're someone who really inspired me in my early days at Bay Area Applied Mycology. It was one of your talks I went to at the Swiss and X Science Auditorium there years ago that really set my brain alight. So it's been a pleasure. Grateful to have the chance. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me to Mushroom Hour. This is a great show.